This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
And you remember we dealt in the Rambam with the fact that the two areas of flaw in a person are in his intellect or in his character, and that a Novi, for a prophet to get close to God, he needs to have extreme greatness in the intellectual area and considerable greatness of character. And we commented that while on the intellect there can be no compromise, a person without great intellect will not get God. And on the character side, even the great ones who did get the Ribbono Shel Olam were not they had character flaws. And the Rambam proceeds in a very basic way to deal with that, without all the cover-ups that we have in Chazal. We've learned that when David sinned on his level, it wasn't really what we thought it was, and then Shlomo, each one of them, and that's true. Clearly, our understanding of what these people did is different, and there's no way that we can really get the grasp of what went on in their lives. But the Rambam makes it very clear: at the end of the day, God held it against them. At the end of the day, God held them responsible for those actions, so they weren't good. However you want to dress it up, it wasn't good. It wasn't right. And he goes through them, and he says very clearly, "V'ein mitnoei hanovi shiyu etzlo kol ma'alos hamidus." And while it is so that a person has to have all the intellectual attributes necessary to be a prophet, he doesn't need to have all of the character attributes to be a prophet. And that's we touched on last week, that ours is the only religion that places such emphasis on the need for intellectual stature in order to have religious stature. That ein am ha'oretz chosid, you cannot be ignorant and frum. You cannot be ignorant and religious. The two just don't go together. It's like saying he's ignorant and he's clever. It just doesn't make sense. To say he's religious, doesn't know very much, but he's religious. It doesn't make sense. It can't be. Does that mean that it's exclusive? Yes, it is exclusive. But anybody who wants it can work on their intellect and study and can make it. But it is exclusive with people who don't. I don't think that there's another religion, as we just discussed, and other religions keep knowledge and intellect in the realm of the clergy. In Judaism, we don't have clergy. That's the truth, we actually don't have clergy. Jewish clergy is a kind of a modern adaptation from the Christian world. We don't have clergy. What is a rabbi? Rabbis weren't allowed to be paid, so what would they do? What did they do in the old days? They were rabbis, and they used to work, they used to have their own businesses. So there was no clergy. And what was their function? Their function was to teach. They were Rosh Hashivas. And Rabbi, and they used to decide on difficult halakhic matters because of their wisdom. They used to decide on difficult matters. But there wasn't all there. Who would daven? And you go into a church, the Havdil. Who davens before the Omer? Who's the chazan? One of the clergy. Who does all the things? One of the clergy. Come into a shul. Who davens? One of the barabbasim. Who wants to daven today? Says, oh, I've got a yotzah. You daven. Who does kriyas haTorah? Anything. The only thing is, if you want to give the drosha, you better be a Talmud Chacham. You don't have to be the rabbi. Be a Talmud Chacham if you enter. The teaching was in the hands of specialists, but not the sacramental stuff. That wasn't in the hands of specialists. We don't have clergy. In the Beis HaMikdash we had Kohanim. That's where the Goyim get it from. The Goyim took it from the Beis HaMikdash. We introduced the concept of Kohuna, of there being a Kohen who is dedicated to temple service. They took it into church services, Lahavir, and their temples. And we took it from their churches into our shuls. That's the process that it went. But in our, as a community structure, we don't have clergy. And we don't have the Hasidim have a little bit the idea of a tzaddik and that kind of thing. We don't have that either. Everybody's meant to be learned. Everybody's meant to be a tzaddik. A rabbi doesn't have extra laws to keep. The same laws apply to him as apply to everybody else. And there's no reason for him to keep Shabbos any more than anybody else to keep Shabbos. People will say in a conservative shul, say, the rabbi doesn't even keep Shabbos. But why should he if nobody else keeps Shabbos? There's no separate law for him. He doesn't have to keep things that everybody else isn't keeping. We don't have that concept. And so that already differentiates us. And furthermore, our highest levels of status are based on, or used to be until very recently, used to be based on learning, on knowledge, on wisdom, on insight, and on character, and on midas. But this applies to everybody. So that's what determines status, not a question of being appointed to a position in the clergy. And the Nevi'im, what were the Nevi'im? They were just Nevi'im were individuals who got to very advanced status, stages of evolution. And that evolution required the ultimate in the intellect, in the intellectual area, and considerable development in the area of character, although not perfection. And he goes through, for example, Shlomo. The Torah says about him, "Begivon Niro Hashem el Shlomo." In Givon, Hashem appeared to Shlomo. It says that. And yet we find in Shlomo HaMelech things that weren't in order in his character. He had a lot of desire and passion. And that manifested in his need for many wives. Now, generally, whenever they deal with Shlomo's many wives, it will be dressed up. He did it for political reasons and to create alliances. And all of that is true, but the Rambam cuts through all that and says, he had many wives because he had a strong sex drive. That was it. He wanted many women. That's what it was. It's the Rambam. It is really.
So why did he have
to marry? What else is he supposed to do? Well, some of them were concubines. Many of them were concubines. But concubines are considered something. They weren't all full wives. Some of them were concubines. But concubines are almost the same as a wife. The only difference with a concubine is she doesn't need a gift for divorce. That's the only difference. But otherwise, he was responsible for her and in every way that was the same. The concubines didn't. I mean, with Sheva Brochus and everything.
Did they have anything?
No, just an agreement. It was an agreement. An agreement of exclusivity while they lived together. The way many men and women live together today without marriage is concubines. What they are is really concubines. They call them girlfriends and boyfriends today, but it's a concubine, is what it means. That's what it is. It's a concubine.
But he was just living with a whole bunch of women then.
He was married to some and living with some. Yeah, had concubines. That's what they
so
are.
So it's not different than the people, I mean.
No, it was very different. Most people have concubines, but they have one. He had 1,000. So he was very different. That's,
You really have 1,000, but it's like.
No. He really had 1,000. Yeah, he had 1,000. I think 300 of them he was married to, and 700 were concubines, I think.
Why did the women not care?
About being a concubine?
Yeah. Like, why would ruin your self-esteem and just be one of many? What's in it for you just that you've been taken care of? Why would women
want to
do that?
Well, there was a strong move to reintroduce that. Firstly, yes, in times of war and things like that, there were many fewer men than women. So the choice was either to allow multiple marriages or to have a lot of single girls, and that's why there was a view when Ashkenazim stopped having more than one wife, there was a view that wasn't the right thing to be doing, that it's not necessarily in the interest of society. So that was the one reason that a woman would agree to do it, because rather than be alone. And there was a kind of a family structure. It wasn't as if she was just like one of the three or the four or the five and all the children. They built a family structure. It wasn't an easy relationship. And it wasn't a recommended relationship. And that's why you'll see among our Gedolim right from the time of the Torah, it was an unusual situation to have more than one wife. So it was never recommended, but it was allowed. And that was one of the reasons it was allowed. Another reason that was considered that it should be allowed is because even today, many women think that they're the only one, but they're not. So at least there was truth and there was openness at that time.
They're not one of 300 usually, they're
really
one of two.
Or 6 or 10, and does it really make a difference when you get to those levels? But in the case of Shlomo HaMelech, yes, certainly there was enormous wealth that was attached to it, an enormous status, and there were political alliances involved in that kind of thing. There might have been all sorts of different reasons for it. I can imagine that there are women today who would do that for the most sought after man, whoever that was, in terms of money and power and being taken care of for the rest of your life. I can imagine that there are women who would go for that and say, why not, rather than be single and struggle, might as well be somebody's concubine. You don't see him in any case, but you get the money.
Like at the Playboy Mansion, one of the things, they're always, there was a guy who was the rest of the security. having read about him, he had made $1 billion, and he had a whole cadre of young women who he took really good care of and traveled with him everywhere he went. And
the whole group at once?
Yeah.
Concubines. There you go. So in the case of Shlomo HaMelech, there was that's the way he operated. That's the way he functioned. But there was a flaw in his character, says the Rambam.
Right.
Sure.
One, is it not true that having sexual relations
if you're living as husband and wife?
So
depends what the understanding is. It depends what the social perception is. So if a couple are living together as husband and wife, they're just not getting married for tax reasons, then they're married and they need a get. But if the idea is, you know, we'll spend a few weeks together, and then if you want to move on, you move on, and if I want to move on, then that's concubines.
Okay. And in Shlomo's time, did all those women have a choice as to whether or not to join the harem?
Sure. V'omar mevoar, and how does the Rambam know this? Because it says very clearly, says the Rambam, Halo al eile chot Shlomo. There's a pasuk in Nehemiah that says, behold, Shlomo sinned in this matter. So you can dress it up as you like, and you can say it was for all sorts of reasons, and you can say, but at the end of the day, the Torah views it as a chet. The Torah views it as a sin. It wasn't something that was good. There was no halachic problem. You were allowed to marry as many women in those days as you wanted to in those days. That wasn't. There was a bit of a halakhic problem because a king wasn't supposed to have more than 18 wives. So he transgressed that. But apart from that, what the Rambam sees it as is a flaw in character, too much, just an excess. There was just too much. It wasn't necessary.
He should have just controlled it? Or there just was, I mean, what is Rambam saying he should do? That he had a flaw in his character, that he had this need.
That's a good question. We'll see that. So at least he did it kind of legitimately. He wasn't deceitful, and he wasn't doing things also. Everything was done properly, and everything, at least there was an openness, and there was and he had the money to be able to do it and to be able to take care of them, and there was a properness in the way he did it, and yet it's seen as a chet. We'll see as we go through some of the others. Some of them almost, they couldn't have done anything else, but it was still wrong. Doing wrong doesn't mean sometimes that if you have no alternative, then it's right. Sometimes even though you have no alternative, it's still wrong. And we'll see that. Let's just go a little bit further. The Chen David HaMelech Olav HaSholem, and David as well, he was a Navi. He says in the book of Shmuel, Li Diber Tzur Yisrael, the Rock of Israel talked to me, says David. So that's a prophet. God communicates with him, so David is a prophet. Umatzano is the Baal HaZaris, and we find that he was cruel. Afal Pishel Oshimesh Bokim Boev De Gilulim Uvahariga Sakopim. Who was he cruel against? Idol worshippers and those who denied God. And he was enormously merciful to the Jewish people. So he controlled his cruelty and he didn't use it incorrectly. But it says quite clearly in Divrei HaYomim, Shashem Yisbach lo hirshor libnos beis hamikdash v'lo yaroi beinav lo zel roi ma shehorag. Hashem wouldn't allow him to build a temple because he had killed too many people. Now you remember when we learned Shmuel, we learned all the other views that it wasn't really because he'd killed them, it was because he was so great, he killed them for such good reason, that he became so powerful that if he'd built the temple, he would never have been able to be destroyed, and that's why God wouldn't let him rebuild it. And we give all these positive spins to the thing, and all that is true, but at the end of the day it says, in Divrei HaYomim, Ato lo tibneh bayis lishmi kidomim rabim shafakta atzalafana. You cannot build my temple because you've killed too many people. Says that, says the Rambam. So however you want to dress it up, God wasn't happy. Even though all his murders and all the things that he killed were for good reason. So what was he meant to be? So what is the Rambam saying? That he's criticized not with the act of killing. None of those killings were sins. God is not saying you were a murderer and you're guilty of death. The way the Rambam is learning it, what is the flaw? There's a character flaw. There was cruelty. Because not everybody could do that. In South Africa, when crime started going up and everybody started getting guns, we used to have three guns at our house. A big one, a middle sized one, a little tiny one that was easy for the women and children to use. The police used to train us on a number of things. They used to train us on how to make sure that you kill and you don't wound, because if you wound, you'll end up in court and you'll end up with all sorts of liabilities, and it's messy. Just if you're going to use it, make sure you kill. And the next thing they trained us in was how to make sure that when you've killed the guy, you put a screwdriver in his hand and make sure that your fingerprints aren't on it so that there can be no question that it was in self-defense, because otherwise you get into messy legal things. And the third thing was don't have a gun if you don't think you can, if you can't use it. And they showed us how people are sure, you know, if somebody comes to me or my children with a knife in their hands, I'll kill them. When somebody's standing in front of you and you're holding a gun at their head and you're looking at pulling that trigger, most people cannot. Just cannot do it. No matter how much in danger, they hesitate, and then it's too late and you're better off without a gun. Not everybody can kill. Even under circumstances of war, not everybody can do it. And the fact that David could do it so much and so easily is a sign of the existence of cruelty. In the Israeli army, when they take the crack units that really have to do some tough things, they train them in incredible cruelty. And part of the purpose of the training is to get people to drop out. The people who can't handle that cruelty shouldn't be in that unit, because sometimes you need to do things in an army that the average person cannot do. And you need cruel people for that. So what does a person do? You ask, what does a person do who has that character flaw? He uses his cruelty. He won't get rid of it. He is like that. The Gemara says, if you have cruelty, become a surgeon, become a moel, become a shochet. There are violent things to do that get rid of some of that element and that are legitimate. And so use your flaws in legitimate areas, which David did. What did he use his cruelty for? To fight God's battles. But God still says, there's too much cruelty to build my temple with. So the fact that you use it well doesn't mean you don't have it. And he wasn't right at this. So the Rambam is saying, look at Shlomo HaMelech, as great as he was, the fact that he had 1,000 wives is considered a flaw. David HaMelech, as great as he was, the fact that he was cruel was considered a problem.
Would it really be a flaw? Or would it be just not the type of person to build a temple?
That's a flaw.
Because if you're a surgeon and you're saving, and you have to have it to save all these lives,
it's a flaw.
The fact that
you can rip somebody open and pull out his heart, and that's a flaw. That you're doing great things, you're doing big mitzvahs with that flaw. Yeah, it's a flaw.
You shouldn't build a temple.
But those aren't the ones who build the temple. Those are the great things, but not build the temple, because the temple is there, designed to atone for people who are violent. And therefore, violent people shouldn't build it. That's what the Torah says.
Using the word flaw, it seems like it's a predisposition that can either be a flaw or be used for the good. So it's something that's there. Is that something that Hashem puts there in
yes.
that person?
But that's the next chapter, chapter 8, which we're going to do. I'm actually going to deviate from what we set out doing, because this is so important. The 8th of the Shemoneh Prokhim, which is the longest one, deals with that whole thing. His opening sentence of the 8th chapter, which we won't do this week, is E'efshar she'yivoled ha'adam mitkilas inyone v'teva ba'al ma'ala v'lo ba'al chison. A person cannot be born with a good quality or bad quality.
Cannot
be born. And yet there are certain things we're born with, and he goes through that. What are you born with? What do you develop? How do you develop? And he goes through that whole issue. But the quality, in other words, what he's saying there is, you're not born with being a wicked person, but you could be born with cruel streaks, and that's there. That will never go away. The question is then to recognize it and to channel it into something which is productive. But even if you do that, as Mrs. Khan says, you're not going to be the temple builder. You'll be something else, but not the temple builder.
So everyone's born with something that's like not good.
Yeah. Except some angels.
You have a problem? Yeah. I thought all the mom. You're talking about like taking dough and stuff.
Yeah. The only great Gedolim have got character flaws for sure. The only ones who don't have character flaws are Jesus, Buddha. They don't have any character flaws. In other religions, you'll find saints who don't have character flaws. In our religion, everybody has character flaws. That's the difference. What can we do? We didn't make it. They seem to have these incredible people that have character flaws. We don't.
But if we didn't have the character flaws, we wouldn't have the surgeons. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Didn't have the character flaws, you wouldn't have the surgeons. If you didn't have the character flaws, you...
That's a funny word.
If you didn't have the character flaws, the Gemara says, you wouldn't have children. you didn't have character flaws, you wouldn't earn a living, you wouldn't go to business.
You wouldn't have children so that they could showcase them for you in color, butterflies.
That's not the reason, because when you have them, you never dream that that's what's going to be the case. You're quite sure that they will exceed you in every way.
So, but four is the right term.
Sure, because angels don't have them. Angels don't have them. There's imperfection, my dear.
Yeah, the problem for me is if you need to...
I know what the problem is. I know what the problem is.
Moral or...
I know what the problem is. Even Latins have flaws.
It's easy to hear that. I won't hear it.
The and so he moves forward. Matzana be Elio zochelotuv, and we even discussed it. We even had it with Elio Hanovi, Elio who didn't even die a natural death. God took him because he was so pure. We find in him midas haragzonos. He lost his temper once. The afal pi sheshivish bo bakoyfim. Who did he lose his temper against? Not his children or his wife or who did he lose his temper against? Kofrim, people who were denying God. He got angry that they were denying God. That's the only time he got angry. God took him away and said to him, he cannot be a ruler or a teacher of men. Too angry, too impatient. Great man, one of the greatest who ever lived, didn't die. God took him in a chariot of fire, reached the highest levels, but can't be a teacher or a leader. Gets too angry. Remember, he was Pinchas, he was the man who killed Zimri. A person who has this kind of kin, or this kind of zealousness, cannot be a teacher or a ruler, because he'll kill people. He'll get so angry with people's inadequacies that he will kill them. But do we need people like that? Of course we need people like that. We need the Shlomos, and we need the Davids, and we need the Eliyahus. But Eliyahu, just as David couldn't build the temple, so Eliyahu cannot be the leader of men. So what I said to the men when I was explaining this piece, what we ought to have, and this is where the Shira got on to Mr. Simon, what we ought to have, really, imagine if we had a zealot like that today, he would be standing at the boardwalk every Shabbos and Sunday, and he would be shouting, and they would have a placard, Pritzers, dress modestly, this is not the way to dress, and how can you be like that, and how can you walk like that in public? Imagine if we had somebody like that shouting and screaming, would that be good or bad?
That would be bad.
That would be great. But we wouldn't give him that person a position. He wouldn't be the rabbi, and he wouldn't be the chazan, and he wouldn't be the bar tefillah. Why would it be great? Because these are the people, and even things we don't agree with. It's incredibly important to see people giving their life for ideals they believe in. Because if we don't see people giving their lives for things they believe in, then the whole concept of giving one's life with Mesiras Nefesh, firstly, the whole concept of Mesiras Nefesh goes. And secondly, being most nefesh for things that are real, otherwise standards disappear altogether. So while there's no legitimacy for throwing stones at cars on Shabbos and things like that, but I remember, I think I mentioned to you one Friday night, I was late, I was walking home from somewhere on Friday night in Israel when I was in Yeshiva, and I'm standing at the street about to cross, and in the area where I was walking, you don't even have to look when you cross, even in the middle of the day on Shabbos, because there are no cars, certainly late at night. As I'm about to cross, a car drives past. And there's a little old man standing next to me, and he says, Shabbos. So I stopped him, and I said, if you want to object, if you're doing a little louder, but they can hear, what are you sitting here muttering under your breath, Shabbos? And he said, I'm not saying it to them, I'm not going to change them, they can do what they want, I just don't want to get used to it. And that's part of the tragedy. We've gotten used to things. We've gotten used to behavior, we've gotten used to dress, we've gotten used to conduct that we would never have tolerated 50 years ago, or 100 years ago, or 20 years ago. And that's how society slides, because there aren't any Eliyahus who stand there and say. Now, if you walk on the boardwalk, there are people that stand with placards saying all sorts of mishugana things, anti-circumcision and anti-this. There are people standing up and shouting and yelling about all sorts of ridiculous ideas. Nobody stands up there and says, you guys are ridiculous. This is not okay. That nobody stands up and says. That we're prepared to accept. Because that's tolerance. And tolerance is a lack of mischievous nefesh. And we discussed at the men what children learn is the things that we give that we're almost a nefesh for. So one of the men said, isn't it disgusting? I mean, the boardwalk, even the advertisements in the middle of the Olympic Games, the way the way people are dressed in the advertisements and all that. Yeah, but children don't learn from being told you can't watch that. Children learn from seeing you turn off the television for yourself. That's what they learn from. Mm-hmm. Children learn from the mysterious nefesh that you show. Not you should. And that's where he came up, because Milt said, you won't go to the boardwalk. And I said, with the greatest of respect, and I'm minimizing your objection to it, that's not mysterious nefesh yet. Not going is not mysterious nefesh. Mysterious nefesh is going and standing with a placard and saying pritzels and having people throw eggs at you and tomatoes at you, and still you stand there and you say pritzels, this is not okay. That's mysterious nefesh. Not going, who gains anything by not going except you, which is great. That's important. But mysterious nefesh is when one takes a stand for something. If it's that bad, make a stand. Mysterious nefesh would be one's going through a very difficult time financially and there's an incredible business deal that can change your life. But all you've got to do is spend 2 minutes on the boardwalk. And you say, I'd rather live in poverty for the rest of my life. That's mysterious nefesh. That a child learns from. And Eliyahu HaNavi is the kind of person who used to be intolerant of any deviation from the standard set by the Torah. So intolerant that he could murder people. And that's why God says, you can't be a leader, you're too dangerous, you're too intolerant, you don't have patience. So who's right, who's wrong? It's a character flaw. He actually calls it a character flaw. And yet Eliyahu used that character flaw well by setting up the extremities of what's acceptable and what isn't acceptable. And I've always said that in order to be down the middle, you need people on the extremes. If you're going to have a reform movement, you'd better have Meir Shorim. Because if you don't have Meir Shorim, before very long, you're the extreme. And the center's out there. The center can only be preserved if you've got an Eliyahu HaNavi out there, and you've got, if you don't have reform people, and you don't have a boardwalk, and you don't have Hollywood, then it's fine. You don't need a Meir Shorim, because the center is somewhere central in any case. But if you've only got the left, and you have no extremists on the right, then the center starts shifting. So you need, when you've got an extremist on the left, you need an extremist of the right, on the right. Is extremism good? No, extremism is bad. But Eliyahu used it well. Society needs the odd extremist. And on lots of the issues, the people are extreme, even the ones we don't agree with. There needs to be a sense of those individuals who are willing to fight for something they believe so that the debate can happen. Otherwise, there's not even a debate. If somebody's like, there's not a discussion about whether the boardwalk's okay or it isn't. And the reason there isn't discussion is because the boardwalks are not that much worse than the rest of the city. It's all over the place. That's how people are today. And we've accepted it. There isn't even a debate about it anymore. And people even walk into the shul like that. Why isn't there a debate anymore? Because the issue isn't dealt with in a... And so with all the issues in society today, if you have a few extremists, a debate takes place. If you have no extremists, the center just shifts.
Saying
it is desirable that somewhere in society there should be people, but then you've got to have an Eliyahu HaNavi. If somebody's going to confront them, it's got to be somebody who's great. You can't confront them when we are as flawed as they are, just in other ways. So you would need an Eliyahu HaNavi. You would need somebody who's very... But what I'm saying is the extremism that you find, for example, in parts of Jerusalem, while we don't like it for ourselves and would never do it and never should, we've got to be careful not to deny its value completely. There is value in extremism in a society. Even though it's wrong and people need to be punished for it, they need to go to jail for it. And it's right to put them in jail for it. And it's right for them to do it and go to jail. You follow what I'm saying? It doesn't mean that because it has to be a crime to interfere with a woman who's going to an abortion clinic. That has to be a crime. And they should be locked up for it. And yet there have to be people who feel so concerned about what's going on that they're willing to go to jail for it. Because that creates debate. And if you don't do that, there isn't debate. And that's a demonstration. It's somebody who feels zealous enough about something to demonstrate, even at great cost to themselves, is something a moral society needs. So Eliyahu HaNavi what he did was wrong, and he lost the opportunity for eternity because of that, and yet he used his anger well. Doing the anger was wrong, but he used it well.
He didn't have eternity?
But in the same sense, he disappeared. He didn't remain on this world eternally. Sorry.
On a practical level, though, protesting or not participating in something is the same as, for an example, for your children, turning off the television, not going to a very wild type of place that would have negative influences for yourself or your family or your children.
There's merit in that. The protest of the Mesiris Nefesh is only when it's at great personal cost. That's when the Mesiris Nefesh is. When the child sees a parent not talking Lashon Hara at great personal cost. When a child sees a parent not breaking Shabbos at great personal cost. Keeping kashrus at great personal cost. Today there are very few things we do at great personal cost. There are very few things. It's a problem. I think it's an enormous problem that our children don't see us doing a whole lot at great personal cost. What they see us is educating them. That's great personal cost.
Not so much because they see us living more for the children as opposed to maybe people have smaller families where they're traveling so much. They're doing. I often talk to my children about families who are very materialistic. Clients I have, people who I know, very materialistic and travel a lot. They say, we don't do that because our emphasis is raising a Torah family. So that, in a way, is a shared method. I don't go out shopping every day and traveling to Paris like people that I associate, that I know, and that in itself, they see me not doing that. That's Monsieur's method.
That is Monsieur's method.
Back to bad examples on the boardwalk. For you to say, to get used to walking there on Yom Tov, and that it's okay, that's saying something to your children.
It's an important discussion. You're right, the Mesiris Nefesh of having a large family is a Mesiris Nefesh. If the children understand it, if we portray to the children that this is better and this is the way to live and we don't want to do that awful stuff what everybody else is doing, well, that's not Mesiris Nefesh. The child then needs to know that what you would really love to do is to go to Paris. That's what you would really like to do. You would also like to drive the cars they do, and you think it's great. And if we keep on undervaluing that, that's nonsense. It's just Kashmir and their cars and their shit, and we don't want to do that. We are into different. Then there's no Mesiris Nefesh. Where's the Mesiris Nefesh? If the Mesiris Nefesh isn't that a beautiful car that person drives, wouldn't it be lovely if we could? But you know what? We're educating you, and that's much more important. That's Mesiris Nefesh.
And it depends. Stop for that. You're talking about this. I mean, no, I don't think any of us say that's not important to our children.
Talk to the children, and find out from the children what they think you think. But don't talk to your children. They won't be honest with you. Talk to somebody else's children. They'll be more honest with you. And you'll get more of a sense, and perhaps we should do that exercise sometimes, more of a sense of what they really believe is important to you. And you will find that what they believe is important to you is not the things you tell them are important to you. They see right through you. And the chances are that what they see is right. So if you want a good reflection, try and get your children to talk honestly to you. It very rarely happens that they feel free enough and able enough and not disrespectful to talk honestly enough about their parents. But a child sees much more easily what's truly important and what isn't important. The issue of the boardwalk, because that addresses the important policy question of why our shul is there, why we leave the shul there. And I explained to the men, if we were living in Yerushalayim or in Bnei Brak or wherever it was, then I would close the shul tomorrow. It would be the wrong place to have it. The problem is we don't, and we fool ourselves if we think the problem's on the boardwalk. The problem is in Pico Boulevard and on Lincoln and on Ozone and in our homes. That's where the problems are. Let's think that by not going on the boardwalk, we're isolating ourselves from the tuna. Because that creates an incredible illusion that makes us feel very comfy, but just isn't true. So when we talked about bad language and so on, I'm much more concerned about hearing bad language in my house or on my street from kids in the community than I am from seeing a drunk on the boardwalk.
That's not where they learn it from.
They do not learn it from the boardwalk. What I teach my kids on the boardwalk is, look what can happen to a person. Firstly, there's a stimulation of the colorfulness of it, which is just that's like a circus. But it's stimulating to a person. That's stimulating to creativity. We start excluding things, so you can't go to movies, and you can't read books, and you can't go to theatre, and you can't listen to good music, and you can't go here, and you can't go there. So the creative ability of the person is completely gone, because there's absolutely no stimulus. And it is a problem that a lot of the creative things involve trifling today, that there's nothing that is pure. Whereas perhaps in older days, one could go to more clean creative experiences. Today there aren't more. So now the question comes, so do you bar the experiences and your child starts growing up without any kind of stimulus, visual stimulus, audio stimulus, the things that makes a mind able to create? Seeing different things is what makes creativity, not seeing the same thing all the time. Seeing diversity, seeing completely different things, seeing weird things. There's a bracha for weirdness. You say a bracha for weird things. When you see a weird human being, you say a bracha. When you see a giant, when you see a dwarf, when you see a black person, you say a bracha. In the siddur, the back of the siddur, the back of the siddur, there's a bracha for every weird experience, because weirdness stimulates one. So we mustn't think that just because it's for certain,
the
bracha
is that we're
not like no, we praise God for the experience of seeing, when you see an unusual animal, there's a bracha. For an elephant, there's a bracha. We don't say it to South Africans because we see them all the time. But the days at the zoos, I suppose, you also don't say the bracha. But when people saw an elephant for the first time, there's a bracha for these things. For weird things, there's a bracha. The Gedolei Yisrael used to go to fairs and watch jugglers and musicians and magicians. My father used to stand there with them. He's told me about it. They used to stand there for long times, watching them and enjoying them. So let's not think that, oh, you know, tumor. The tumor's all over the place. So, and by excluding the children from all of that, firstly, they go looking for it elsewhere. And secondly, one damages their creative input. What does one do with that? The lesson that I give my children is, look at that man there. Go and talk to that man there. You'll find he's got a university degree. That's what can happen to a human being. He got onto drugs, he got into a bad group of people, and that's where he is. Stop and look and see where you can get to. And you see that one there, he's Jewish. Go and talk Yiddish to him. And you'll find he grew up in a kosher home. Did his parents ever think he would land up like that? Go and have a look at that person instead of insulating them from it. So I'm not prepared to buy that it's only negative. Even though it has positives, if we were living in a very holy environment, I would never want anybody to walk there. Certainly wouldn't think of having a shul there. But since we're not living in a holy environment, I think there can be a lot to gain and not only to lose. My point is, though, there are aspects of that we shouldn't become used to. But merely not going doesn't avoid us not necessarily becoming used to it. So without minimizing what you're doing is a protest, and there's value in it. It's complicated, and in the value of that, don't be so quick to consider those who don't handle it the way you're handling it, which is an okay way to be handling it. But there are other ways to be handling it too. What's important is that in all cases, there's an understanding of the value in what we call a kanoi. Somebody who doesn't say, I don't go there. A kanoi goes there. A kanoi goes there. Kanoi in Yerushalayim, they go to Ben Yehuda Street on Friday night, and they confront the young people, and they say, why aren't you in shul? And they get into a debate, and sometimes there's some harsh words. That's what a kanoi does. A kanoi doesn't say, I was working with my uncle is a kanoi, son of Rebellion. The only one is a kanoi. Most of Rebellion's children were very, very quiet and did their own thing and minded their own business. But Reblazer is a kanoi. And I was a young boy walking with him one Friday night in Eretz Israel, and he walked up to a huge Israeli, one of these real muscular young Israelis on Friday night, just smoking a cigarette. And he took the cigarette out of his face. He didn't know a stranger. He took the cigarette out of his mouth and slapped his face and said, aren't you ashamed of yourself at Shabbos? And I'm sitting there and looking at him. And he was some.
The guy didn't do anything?
I was so astonished. He just looked. I expected him to hit him. He just looked and there. The laser just walked on. Oh, man. I don't know whether it had any impact on that man or not, but I do know. It's like fire in my mind. I'll never forget it. Why did the blazer do it? Not because he wanted to pick up a fight. Couldn't stand in Israel. He had just come to Israel. He was here, only been there for a few weeks. He couldn't stand finally coming to Israel from England and through Europe and the war and the Holocaust. Finally, he comes to Israel. And on Shabbos, that's what goes on there. That's a kanoi. A kanoi is not a person that says, I won't look at it, I won't see it. A kanoi is somebody who goes up there and says, I will engage with you. I think what you're doing is disgusting. Now let's talk about it. That's a kanoi. And that's what Eliyahu was. Is that anger? And is anger good? No, anger is bad. But those people who have that violent streak, use it in that way. Does that mean you'll build a temple? No. Does that mean you can be a leader? No, you cannot be a leader if you're like that. And Reb Lezer was never a good leader, never a good rabbi, never a good leader. He's a poet, he's an artist. He writes the most beautiful poetry. And he's a big Talmid Chacham, and he understands and learns unbelievably well. But has he been a successful leader of people? Of course not. You cannot be a successful leader of people. But he's a Kanoi. He's a zealot. This is Khan and Desi.
What about not putting temptation in front of
yourself? Again, if there was no temptation anywhere else, that would be right. If you're safe, if you could say to yourself, if I don't go to the boardwalk, you know what? I won't have any temptations, then don't go to the boardwalk. But what, so you won't go to the boardwalk, but you'll walk down Lincoln, pop the department store, you'll open a newspaper. Where is the big... if you don't want temptation, then you've got to live in a different kind of a world. And today there probably aren't such worlds anymore. And that's part of the emotion. We'll understand that when he judges us, that he, for the first time in society, put us in a place where there are no shtetls. Because there's a computer in every shtetl, and there are all sorts of things. We cannot insulate ourselves anymore. Not only can we not insulate ourselves from everything, we can no longer insulate ourselves from anything. And that's the world God has put us into, and there's a reason for having done that, for whatever the reason is, and we need to engage and understand that and handle it as best we can. But staying away from the boardwalk is not going to keep us away from temptation as much as it is. And there are ways of handling it and ways of dealing with it. Desi and then Leslie.
I don't understand why those people don't make the leaders. They believe in
because people leave them. People can't follow them.
So what do you say? What kind of leader do you need? A blah person?
No, something between a blah person and a zealot. A zealot is a person who every time he does something, somebody does something wrong, he executes them. That's a zealot. And a blah person is every time somebody does something wrong, he turns the other way. A leader will slowly engage them and say, look, this is what's happening. Let's design an educational program. Let's try and teach children that this isn't the way to be. It will be a long-term correction. But that way, people can deal with that. People can handle that. And he will change society.
But he still feels that he wants to.
Yes, he's passionate.
He's passionate about it.
But he doesn't act.
The way he does it is different.
Yes, he doesn't act. The anger doesn't always come out. He's not that angry about it that he can't keep it in. The zealot, he's so passionate about it that he just can't keep it in. And that's great, but not for leadership. And the leader is not somebody who doesn't feel anything. He feels it. But not that passionately that he can't deal with it in other ways. And that's it. Isn't it?
As far as an ordinary person,
not different kinds of responses, and obviously this is a long topic as to how you evaluate when, and one says, had the first person in Nazi Germany who'd done that been opposed, would it have happened or wouldn't it have happened? And the issue there is not just my own reaction, it's a question of what are the long term, at what point do you start interfering? And are there legal ways of doing it, and so on? So I think that is a discussion, but not for now, in terms of one's immediate thing is one to hit out, and sometimes that is for those reasons, to write if that's what you decide is the appropriate thing.